had died naturally would be abhorrent for him. All three men held the same conviction. Cannibalism wouldn't be considered, then or ever. The two-week mark was a different kind of turning point for Louis. He began to pray aloud. He had no idea how to speak to God, so he recited snippets of prayers that he'd heard in movies. Phil bowed his head as Louis spoke, offering Amen at the end. Mac only listened. The rafts slid on the current, their tethers snaking behind them. It seemed that they were still drifting west, but without any points of reference, the men weren't sure. At least they were going somewhere. The second albatross fluttered onto Louis's head sometime around the 14th day. Again, Louis slowly raised his hand, snatched it, and killed it. The men sat there looking at it, remembering the stench of the first albatross. When Louis opened it up, they were happily surprised to find that it didn't smell that bad. Still, no one wanted to eat it. Louis portioned the meat and insisted that everyone eat. All three men forced the meat down. Because Max seemed to need food the most, they gave him all of the blood. In the bird's stomach, they found several small fish, which they decided to use as bait. And with them, Louis caught one more fish. He saved some of the bird meat for bait and set the bones out to dry in hopes that they might be useful as fish hooks. Time spun out endlessly. Louis caught a few fish, once parlaying a tiny one, thrown into the raft by a whitecap, into bait that yielded a comparatively fat pilot fish. Rains came intermittently, leaving the men sucking up every drop that fell into their rain catchers. Louis and Phil took turns leading prayers each night. Mac remained in his own world. The men grew thinner. Phil was gradually regaining his strength after his initial state of concussed exhaustion. Mac's body grew weaker, following his broken spirit. Then the rains stopped, and the water tins dried up. They reached day 21. They caught a fish and had a little celebration for passing what they thought was Rickenbacker's mark. For some time, Louis had noticed a stomach-turning reek wafting to and fro over them. It was coming from Phil's head. The blood on his t-shirt bandage was rotting, and cakes of it were chipping off and falling into the raft. Phil couldn't smell it, but Louis couldn't bear it. Louis untied the t-shirt and gently unwrapped it. Beneath a thick cake of dried blood, the wounds had knit neatly. The bleeding didn't resume. The t-shirt could go. A few days later, Louis saw something bizarre. The edge of the sea, flush to the horizon, was peeling upward. A vast black rim formed, rose up, and began speeding toward them with a tumbling motion. Louis shouted a warning, and the other two men wheeled around toward it. They dropped down, getting their weight as low as possible so they wouldn't be flipped over. As the wave closed in, they braced themselves. Just as the wave reached them, they realized it wasn't a wave at all. It was a giant school of dolphins, swimming with astonishing speed. The dolphins rushed at the rafts and were soon muscling all around them. Looking into the water, Phil saw small fish, thousands of them, seeming to fill the ocean. The dolphins were chasing them. The men thrust their arms into the water and tried to grab some, but the fish slipped through their fingers. If they had had a net, they could have whisked it through the water and filled the rafts. But with only their fingers, they couldn't snare even one. Louis was out of bait. Other than the sharks, the only fish that ventured near the rafts were pilot fish, which hugged the sides of the sharks as they circled. They were within easy reach. Only when Louis tried to grab them, they squirted away. The sharks had stolen every hook small enough to fit in the mouths of pilot fish, so Louis tried albatross bones, but the fish spat them out. Looking at the fish line that he had left, he got an idea. He cut off small portions of line, tied them to the large fish hooks, and then tied three hooks to the fingers of one hand, one on his pinky, one on his middle finger, one on his thumb, orienting them as if they were claws. He held his hand over the water's surface and waited. A shark, attended by a pilot fish, swam by. Once its head had passed, Louis sank his hand into the water. When the unsuspecting pilot fish moved under his hand, he snapped his fingers shut around its back. The hooks dug in. Louis yanked the fish out of the water, jubilant. Sometime that week, a small tern landed on the wall of the raft, right between the men. It was closest to Phil, and without speaking, the men indicated to each other that he'd catch it. Phil clapped down on the bird. It was tiny and offered little meat, but not long after, another tern settled on the raft. This time, Mac caught it. Louis was so famished that he went at it with his teeth, ripping the feathers loose and spitting them out in whuffs. Almost immediately, he felt a crawling sensation on his chin. The tern had been covered in lice, which were now hopping over his face. Something about the tickle of lice on his skin rattled Louis more than anything he had yet encountered. He began scratching and rubbing at his face, but he couldn't get at the lice, which had burrowed into his beard and were moving up his head and into his hair. He pitched his upper body into the water. Phil and Mac, realizing that Louis was going to get his head ripped off, grabbed the oars and bumped the sharks away while Louis splashed about trying to drown the lice. After about a half a dozen dunks, the tickle was gone. As the days passed, the men caught three, perhaps four more birds. One bird kept dipping low over the raft, then soaring off again. Mac suddenly shot his hand up and snagged the bird by the leg in midair, then handed the squirming animal to Louis, who was amazed at Mac's alacrity. The men ate every morsel of the bird, and every other bird that they caught, leaving only feathers and bones. For days, Louis lay over the side of the raft, fish hooks tied to his fingers, trying to catch another pilot fish. He caught none. The water ran out again, and the thirst was agonizing. Day after day passed with no rain. Twice, the men rowed toward distant squalls, but each time the rain sputtered out just as they reached it, leaving them exhausted and demoralized. When the next squall inched along the horizon, none of them had the strength to chase it. The intense thirst and overheating drove Phil to do something almost suicidal. He waited for the sharks to wander a short distance away, then pulled himself overboard. Louis and Mac knelt near him, jabbing at sharks with the oars as Phil hung on the raft, savoring the cool water and swishing big mouthfuls of it over his tongue before spitting them out. He only just had the strength to drag himself back in. Since Phil had gotten away with it, the other two thought it worth a try and took their turns in the water. The men were able to keep the sharks away long enough for all three to have a dip. On the sixth day without water, the men recognized that they weren't going to last much longer. Mac was failing especially quickly. They bowed their heads together as Louis prayed. If God would quench their thirst, he vowed, he'd dedicate his life to him. The next day, by divine intervention or the fickle humors of the tropics, the sky broke open and rain poured down. Twice more the water ran out, twice more they prayed, and twice more the rain came. The showers gave them just enough water to last a short while longer. If only a plane would come. Chapter 15. Sharks and Bullets. On the morning of the 27th day, a plane came. It began with a rumble of engines, and then a spot in the sky. It was a twin-engine bomber, moving west at a brisk clip. It was so far away that expending the flares and dye was questionable. The men conferred and voted. They decided to take a shot. Louis fired one flare, reloaded, then fired a second, drawing vivid lines across the sky. He opened a dye container and spilled its contents into the ocean, then dug out the mirror and angled a square of light toward the bomber. The men waited, hoping. The plane grew smaller, then faded away. As the castaways slumped in the rafts, trying to accept another lost chance, over the western horizon, there was a glimmer, tracing a wide curve, then banking toward the rafts. The bomber was coming back. Weeping with joy, Louis, Phil, and Mac tugged their shirts over their heads and snapped them back and forth in the air, calling out. The bomber leveled off, skimming over the water. Louis squinted at the cockpit. He made out two silhouettes, pilot and co-pilot. He thought of Palmyra, food, solid ground underfoot. And then, all at once, the ocean erupted. There was a deafening noise, and the rafts began hopping and shuddering under the castaways. The gunners were firing at them. Louis, Phil, and Mac clawed for the raft walls and threw themselves overboard. They swam under the rafts and huddled there, watching bullets tear through the rafts and cut bright slits in the water around them. Then the firing stopped. The men surfaced. The bomber had overshot them and was now to the east, moving away. Two sharks were nosing around. The men had to get out of the water immediately. Clinging to the side of Louis and Mac's raft, Phil was completely done in. The leap into the water had taken everything that was left in him. He floundered, unable to pull himself over the raft wall. Louis swam up behind him and gave him a push, and Phil slopped up on board. Mac, too, needed Louis's help to climb over the wall. Louis then dragged himself up, and the three sat there, stunned but uninjured. They couldn't believe that the airmen, mistaking them for Japanese, would strafe unarmed castaways. Under them, the raft felt doughy. It was leaking air. In the distance, the bomber swung around and began flying at the rafts again. Louis hoped that the crew had realized the mistake and was returning to help them. Flying about 200 feet over the water, the bomber raced at them, following a path slightly parallel to the rafts, so that its side passed into view. All three men saw it at once. Behind the wing, painted over the waist, was a red circle. The bomber was Japanese. Louis saw the gunners taking aim, and knew he had to go back in the water. Phil and Mac didn't move. They were both exhausted. They knew that if they went overboard again, they wouldn't be strong enough to get back in, and the sharks would take them. If they stayed on the raft, it seemed impossible that the gunners could miss them. As the bomber flew toward them, they lay down. Phil pulled his knees to his chest and covered his head in his hands. Mac balled himself up beside him. Louis took a last glance at them, then dropped into the water and swam back under the rafts. The bullets showered the ocean in a glittering downpour. Looking up, Louis saw them popping through the canvas, shooting beams of intensely bright tropical sunlight through the raft's shadow. But after a few feet, the bullets spent their force and fluttered down, fizzing. Louis straightened his arms over his head and pushed against the bottom of one of the rafts, trying to get far enough down to be outside the bullet's lethal range. Above him, he could see the depressions formed by Mac and Phil's bodies. Neither man was moving. As the bullets raked overhead, Louis struggled to stay under the rafts. The current clutched at him, rotating his body horizontally and dragging him away. He kicked against it, but it was no use. He was being sucked away, and he knew that if he lost touch with the rafts, he wouldn't be able to swim hard enough against the current to get back. As he was pulled loose, he saw the long cord that strayed off the end of one of the rafts. He grabbed it and tied it around his waist. As he lay underwater, his legs tugged in front of him by the current, Louis looked down at his feet. His left sock was pulled up on his shin. His right had slipped halfway off. He watched it flap in the current. Then, in the murky blur beyond it, he saw the huge, gaping mouth of a shark emerge out of the darkness and rush straight at his legs. Louis recoiled, pulling his legs toward his body. The current was too strong for him to get his legs beneath him, but he was able to swing them to the side, away from the shark's mouth. The shark kept coming, directly at Louis's head. Louis remembered the advice of the old man in Honolulu. Make a threatening expression, then stiff-arm the shark's snout. As the shark lunged for his head, Louis bared his teeth, widened his eyes, and rammed his palm into the tip of the shark's nose. The shark flinched, circled away, then swam back for a second pass. Louis waited until the shark was inches from him, then struck it in the nose again. Again, the shark peeled away. Above, the bullets had stopped coming. As quickly as he could, Louis pulled himself along the cord until he reached the raft. He grabbed its wall and lifted himself clear of the shark. Mac and Phil were lying together in the fetal position. They were absolutely still, and bullet holes dappled the raft around them. Louis shook Mac. Mac made a sound. Louis asked if he'd been hit. Mac said no. Louis spoke to Phil. Phil said he was okay. The bomber circled back for another go. Phil and Mac played dead, and Louis tipped back into the ocean. As bullets knifed the water around him, the shark came at him, and again Louis bumped its snout and repelled it. Then a second shark charged at him. Louis hung there, gyrating in the water and flailing his arms and legs as the sharks snapped at him and the bullets came down. The moment the bomber sped out of firing range, he clambered onto the raft again. Phil and Mac were still unhit. Four more times the Japanese strafed them, sending Louis into the water to kick and punch at the sharks until the bomber had passed. Though he fought them to the point of exhaustion, he was not bitten. Every time he emerged from the water, He was certain that Phil and Mac would be dead. Impossibly, though there were bullet holes all the way around the men, even in the tiny spaces between them, not one bullet had hit either man. The bomber crew made a last gesture of sadism. The plane circled back, and Louis ducked into the water again. The plane's bomb bay doors rolled open, and a depth charge tumbled out, splashing down some 50 feet from the rafts. The men braced themselves for an explosion, but none came. Either the charge was a dud, or the bombardier had forgotten to arm it. If the Japanese are this inept, Phil thought, America will win this war. Louis rolled back onto the raft and collapsed. When the bomber came back, he was too tired to go overboard. As the plane passed a final time, Louis, Mac, and Phil lay still. The gunners didn't fire. The bomber flew west and disappeared. Phil's raft had been slashed in two. A bullet had struck the air pump and ricocheted straight across the base of the raft, slitting it from end to end. Everything that had been in the raft had been lost in the water. Because the ruined raft was made from rubberized canvas, it didn't sink, but it was obviously far beyond repair. Shrunken and formless, it lapped about on the ocean surface. The men were sardined together on what remained of Mac and Louis's raft, which was far too small for all three of them. The canvas was speckled with tiny bullet holes. The raft had two air chambers, but both were punctured. Each time one of the men moved, air sighed out of the chambers and the canvas wrinkled a little more. The raft sat lower and lower in the water. The sharks whipped around it, surely excited by the bullets, the sight and smell of men in the water, and the sinking raft. As the men sat together, exhausted and in shock, a shark lunged up over the wall of the raft, mouth open, trying to drag a man into the ocean. Someone grabbed an oar and hit the shark, and it slid off. Then another shark jumped on, and, after it, another. The men gripped the oars and wheeled about, frantically swinging at the sharks. As they turned and swung and the sharks flopped out, air was forced out of the bullet holes, and the raft sank deeper. Soon, part of the raft was completely submerged. If the men didn't get air into the raft immediately, the sharks would take them. One pump had been lost in the strafing. Only the one from Mac and Louis's raft remained. The men hooked it up to one of the two valves and took turns pumping as hard as they could. Air flowed into the chamber and seeped out through the bullet holes, but the men found that if they pumped very quickly, just enough air passed through the raft to lift it up in the water and keep it mostly inflated. The sharks kept coming, and the men kept beating them away. As Phil and Mac pumped and struck at the sharks, Louis groped for the provisions pocket and grabbed the patching kit, which contained sheets of patching material, a tube of glue, and sandpaper to roughen up the raft surface so the glue could adhere. The first problem declared itself immediately. The sandpaper wasn't waterproof. When Louis pulled it out, only the paper emerged. The sand that had been stuck to it had washed off. For the umpteenth time, Louis cursed whoever had stocked the raft. He had to devise something that would etch up the patch area so the glue would stick. He pondered the problem, then picked up the brass mirror that he had used to hail the bomber. Using the pliers, he cut three teeth into the edge of the mirror. Phil and Mac kept fighting the sharks off. Louis began patching, starting with the holes on the top of the raft. He lifted the perforated area clear of the water, wiped the water from the surface, and held it away from the waves, letting it dry in the sun. Then, with each perforation, he used the mirror edge to cut an X across the hole. The material consisted of two layers of canvas with rubber between. After cutting the X, he peeled back the canvas to reveal the rubber layer, used the mirror to scratch up the rubber, squeezed glue onto it, and stuck the patch on. Then he waited for the sun to dry the glue. Sometimes a whitecap would drench the patch before it dried, and he'd have to begin again. As Louis worked, keeping his eyes on the patches, the sharks kept snapping at him. Growing wiser, they gave up flinging themselves haphazardly at the men and began stalking about, waiting for a moment when an oar was down or a back was turned before bullying their way aboard. Over and over again, they lunged at Louis from behind where he couldn't see him. Mac and Phil smacked them away. Hour after hour, the men worked, rotating the duties, clumsy with fatigue. The pumping was an enormous exertion for the diminished men. They found that instead of standing the pump up and pushing the handle downward, it was easier to press the pump handle to their chests and pull the base toward themselves. All three men were indispensable. Had there been only two, they couldn't have pumped, patched, and repelled sharks. For the first time on the raft, Mac was truly helpful. He was barely strong enough to pull the pump handle a few times in a row, but with the oar, he kept every shark away. Night fell. In the darkness, patching was impossible, but the pumping couldn't be stopped. They pumped all night long, so drained that they lost the feeling in their arms. In the morning, the patching resumed. The rate of air loss gradually lessened, and they were able to rest for longer periods. Eventually, the air held enough for them to begin brief sleep rotations. Once the top was patched, there was the problem of patching the bottom, which was underwater. All three men squeezed onto one side of the raft, balancing on one air tube. They opened up the valve and let the air out of the side they weren't sitting on, lifted it clear of the water, turned it over so the bottom faced skyward, wiped it off, and held it up to dry. Then Louis began patching. When that half of the bottom was patched, they reinflated it, crawled onto the repaired side, deflated the other side, and repeated the process. Again, whitecaps repeatedly washed over the raft and spoiled the patches, and everything had to be redone. Finally, they could find no more holes to patch. Because bubbles kept coming up around the sides of the raft, they knew there were holes someplace where they couldn't reach. They had to live with them. The patches had slowed the air loss dramatically. Even when struck by whitecaps, the patches held. The men found that they could cut back on their pumping to one session every 15 minutes or so during the day, and none at night. With the raft now reasonably inflated, the sharks stopped attacking. Losing Phil's raft was a heavy blow. Not only had they lost all of the items stored on it, but now three men were wedged in a two-man raft, so close together that to move, each man had to ask the others to give him room. There was so little space that they had to take turns straightening their legs. At night, they had to sleep in a bony pile, feet to head. But two good things came from the strafing. Looking at the dead raft, Louis thought of a use for it. Using the pliers, he pulled apart the layers of canvas on the ruined raft, creating a large, light sheet. At last, they had a canopy to block the sun in daytime and the cold at night. The other benefit of the strafing was the information it gave the men. When they had a moment to collect themselves, Louis and Phil discussed the Japanese bomber. They thought that it must have come from the Marshall or Gilbert Islands. If they were right in their belief that they were drifting directly west, then the Marshalls and Gilberts were roughly equidistant from them. They thought that the bomber had probably been on sea search, and if the Japanese followed the same sea search procedures as the Americans, it would have taken off at around 7 a.m., a few hours before it had reached the rafts. Estimating the bomber's cruising speed and range, they made rough calculations to arrive at how many hours the bomber could remain airborne after it left them, and thus how far they were from its base. They guessed that they were some 850 miles from the bomber's base. If this was correct, given that they had crashed about 2,000 miles east of the Marshalls and Gilberts, they had already traveled more than half the distance to those islands and were covering more than 40 miles per day. Phil thought over the numbers and was surprised. They had had no idea that they were so far west. Extrapolating from these figures, they made educated guesses of when they'd reach the islands. Phil guessed the 46th day. Louis guessed the 47th. If their figures were right, they were going to have to last about twice as long as Rickenbacker. That meant surviving on the raft for almost three more weeks. It was frightening to imagine what might await them on those islands. The strafing had confirmed what they'd heard about the Japanese. But it was good to feel oriented, to know that they were drifting toward land somewhere out there, on the far side of the Earth's tilt. The bomber had given them something to ground their hope. Mac didn't join in on the prognostication. He was slipping away. Chapter 16. Singing in the Clouds. Louis sat awake, looking into the sea. Phil was asleep. Mac was virtually catatonic. Two sharks, about 8 feet long, were placidly circling the raft. Each time one slid past, Louis studied its skin. He had banged sharks on the nose many times, but had never really felt the hide, which was said to feel like sandpaper. Curious, he dropped a hand into the water and laid it lightly on a passing shark, feeling its back and dorsal fin as it slid beneath him. It felt rough, just as everyone said. The shark swished on. A second shark passed, and Louis again let his hand follow its body. Beautiful, he thought. Soon after, Louis noticed something odd. Both sharks were gone. Never in 4 weeks had the sharks left. Louis got up on his knees and leaned out over the water, looking as far down as he could, puzzled. No sharks. He was kneeling there, perched over the edge of the raft, when one of the sharks that he had touched leapt from the water at terrific speed, mouth wide open, lunging straight at his head. Louis threw both hands in front of his face. The shark collided with him head-on, trying to get its mouth around his upper body. Louis, his hands on the animal's snout, shoved as hard as he could, and the shark splashed back into the water. A moment later, the second shark jumped up. Louis grabbed an oar and struck the shark on the nose, and it jerked back and slid away. Then the first shark lunged for him again. Louis was recoiling when he saw an oar swing past, sending the animal backward into the ocean. To Louis's surprise, it wasn't Phil who had saved him. It was Mac. Louis had no time to thank him. One of the sharks jumped up again, followed by the other. Louis and Mac sat side by side, clubbing each shark as it lunged at them. Mac was a new man. A moment before, he had seemed almost comatose. Now he was infused with frantic energy. For several minutes, the sharks took turns bellying onto the raft with gaping mouths, always launching themselves from the same spot. Finally, they gave up. Louis and Mac collapsed. Phil, who had been startled awake, but had been unable to help because there were only two oars, stared at them in groggy confusion. "What happened?" he said. Louis looked at Mac with happy amazement and told him how grateful and proud of him he was. Mac, crumpled on the bottom of the raft, smiled back. He had pushed himself beyond his body's capacities, but the frightened, childlike expression had left his face. Mac had reclaimed himself. Louis was furious at the sharks. He had thought they had an understanding. The men would stay out of the sharks' turf, the water, and the sharks would stay off of theirs, the raft. That the sharks had taken shots at him when he had gone overboard and when the raft had been mostly submerged after the strafing had seemed fair enough. But their attempt to poach men from their reinflated raft struck Louis as dirty pool. He stewed all night, scowled hatefully at the sharks all day, and eventually made a decision. If the sharks were going to try to eat him, he was going to try to eat them. He knelt by the raft wall and watched the sharks, searching for a beatable opponent. One that looked about 5 feet long passed. Louis thought he could take it. Louis and Phil made a plan. They had a little bait on the raft, probably the remains of their last bird. Phil hung it on a fish hook and strung it into the water at one end of the raft. At the other end, Louis knelt, facing the water. Smelling the bait, the shark swam toward Phil, orienting itself so that its tail was under Louis. Louis leaned as far overboard as he could without losing his balance, plunged both hands into the water, and grabbed the tail. The shark took off. Louis, gripping the tail, flew out of the raft and crashed into the water, sending a large serving of the Pacific up his nose. The shark whipped its tail and flung Louis off. Louis bolted back onto the raft so quickly that he later had no memory of how he had done it. Soaking and embarrassed, Louis rethought his plan. His first error had been one of appraisal. Sharks were stronger than they looked. His second had been to fail to brace himself properly. His third had been to allow the shark's tail to stay in the water, giving the animal something to push against. He settled in to wait for a smaller shark. In time, a smaller one, perhaps 4 feet long, arrived. Louis knelt at the raft's side, tipping his weight backward and keeping his knees far apart to brace himself. Phil dangled a baited hook in the water. The shark swam for the bait. Louis clapped his hands around the tail and heaved it out of the water. The shark thrashed, but could neither get free nor pull Louis into the water. Louis dragged the animal onto the raft. The shark twisted and snapped, and Phil grabbed a flare cartridge and jammed it into the shark's mouth. Pinning the shark down, Louis took the pliers and stabbed the screwdriver end of the handle through the animal's eye. The shark died instantly. In his Honolulu survival course, Louis had been told that the liver was the only part of a shark that was edible. Getting at it was no mean feat. Even with a knife, shark skin is about as easy to cut as a coat of mail. With only the edge of a mirror to cut with, the labor was draining. After much sawing, Louis managed to break the skin. The flesh underneath stank of ammonia. Louis cut the liver out, and it was sizable. They ate it eagerly, giving Mac a larger portion, and for the first time since breakfast on May 27th, they were all full. The rest of the shark reeked, so they threw it overboard. Later, using the same technique, they caught a second shark and again ate the liver. Among the sharks, word seemed to get around. No more small sharks came near. Large sharks, some as long as 12 feet, lumbered alongside the raft, but Louis thought better of taking them on. The men's stomachs were soon empty again. Mac was in a sharp downward spiral. He rarely moved. All three men had lost a staggering amount of weight, but Mac had shriveled the most. His eyes, sunken in their sockets, stared out lifelessly. It was nightfall, somewhere around the 30th day. The men went through their usual routine, bailing water into the raft and entwining themselves for warmth. The sky was clear and starry, and the moon shone on the water. The men fell asleep. Louis woke to a tremendous crash, stinging pain, and the sensation of weightlessness. His eyes snapped open, and he realized that he, Mac, and Phil were airborne. They flopped down together onto the raft and twisted about in confusion. Something had struck the bottom of the raft with awesome power. The garden variety sharks that made up their entourage weren't large enough to hit them with such force, and had never behaved in this way. Looking over the side of the raft, they saw it. Swelling up from under the water came a leviathan, a vast white mouth, a broad back parting the surface, and a long dorsal fin, ghostly in the moonlight. The animal was some 20 feet long, more than 3 times the length of the raft. Louis recognized its features from his survival school training. It was a great white shark. As the castaways watched in terrified silence, the shark swam the length of one side of the raft, then bent around to the other side, exploring it. Pausing on the surface, it swished its tail away, then slapped it into the raft, sending the raft skidding sideways and splashing a wave of water onto the men. Louis, Mac, and Phil came up on their knees in the center of the raft and clung to one another. The shark began to swim around to the other side. Louis whispered, "Don't make a noise." Again came the mighty swing, the shower of water, the jolt through the raft and the men. Around and around the shark went, drenching the raft with each pass. It seemed to be playing with the raft. With every pass, the men cringed and waited to be capsized. Finally, the great back slid under, and the sea smoothed behind it. It did not surface again. Louis, Phil, and Mac lay down again. The water around them was now cold, and none of them could sleep. The next morning, Mac could no longer sit up. He lay on the floor of the raft, little more than a wrinkled mummy, his gaze fixed far away. One last albatross landed. Louis caught it, wrenched its head off, and handed it to Phil. Phil turned it upside down over Mac and let the blood flow into his mouth. As Louis and Phil ate the meat, dipping it into the ocean to give it flavor, they fed bits to Mac, but it didn't revive him. In subsequent days, Mac became a faint whisper of a man. His water tins ran dry. When Phil opened his tin and took a sip of the little he had left, Mac asked if he could drink from it. For Phil, thirst had been the cruelest trial, and he knew that the water left in his tin, essential to his own survival, couldn't save Mac. He gently told Mac that he didn't have enough left to share. Louis was sympathetic to Phil, but he couldn't bring himself to refuse Mac. He gave him a small sip of his own water. That evening, Phil heard a small voice. It was Mac, asking Louis if he was going to die. Louis looked over at Mac, who was watching him. Louis thought it would be disrespectful to lie to Mac, who might have something that he needed to say or do before life left him. Louis told him that he thought he'd die that night. Mac had no reaction. Phil and Louis lay down, put their arms around Mac, and went to sleep. Sometime that night, Louis was lifted from sleep by a breathy sound, a deep outrushing of air, slow and final. He knew what it was. Sergeant Francis McNamara had begun his last journey with a panicked act, consuming the raft's precious food stores, and in doing so, he had placed himself and his raft mates in the deepest jeopardy. But in the last days of his life, in the struggle against the deflating raft and the jumping sharks, he had given all he had left. It wasn't enough to save him. It had probably hastened his death. But it may have made the difference between life and death for Phil and Louis. Had Mac not survived the crash, Louis and Phil might well have been dead by that 33rd day. In his dying days, Mac had redeemed himself. In the morning, Phil wrapped Mac's body in something, probably part of the ruined raft. They knelt over the body and said aloud all of the good things they knew of Mac, laughing a little at his penchant for mess hall pie. Louis wanted to give him a religious eulogy, but didn't know how, so he recited disjointed passages that he remembered from movies, ending with a few words about committing the body to the sea. And he prayed for himself and Phil, vowing that if God would save them, he would serve heaven forever. When he was done, Louis lifted the shrouded body in his arms. It felt as if it weighed no more than 40 pounds. Louis bent over the side of the raft and gently slid Mac into the water. Mac sank away. The sharks let him be. The next night, Louis and Phil completed their 34th day on the raft. Though they didn't know it, they had passed what was almost certainly the record for survival adrift in an inflated raft. If anyone had survived longer, they hadn't lived to tell about it. The raft bobbed westward. Petulant storms came over now and then, raining enough to keep the water supply steady. Because the water ration was now divided by two instead of three, each man had more to drink. Louis made a hook out of his lieutenant's pin and caught one fish before the pin broke. Phil and Louis could see the bend of their thigh bones under their skin, their knees bulging in the centers of bird-like legs, their bellies hollow, their ribs stark. Each man had grown a weedy beard. Their skin glowed yellow from the leached raft dye, and their bodies were patterned with salt sores. They held their sun-scorched eyes to the horizon, searching for land, but there was none. Their hunger dimmed, an ominous sign. They had reached the last stage of starvation. One morning, they woke to a strange stillness. The rise and fall of the raft had ceased, and it sat virtually motionless. There was no wind. The ocean stretched out in all directions in glossy smoothness, regarding the sky and reflecting its image in crystalline perfection. Like the Ancient Mariner, Louis and Phil had found the doldrums, the eerie pause of wind and water that lingers around the equator. They were, as Coleridge wrote, as idle as a painted ship upon a painted ocean. It was an experience of transcendence. Phil watched the sky, whispering that it looked like a pearl. The water looked so solid that it seemed they could walk across it. When a fish broke the surface far away, the sound carried to the men with absolute clarity. They watched as pristine ringlets of water circled outward around the place where the fish had passed, then faded to stillness. For a while they spoke, sharing their wonder. Then they fell into reverent silence. Their suffering was suspended. They weren't hungry or thirsty. They were unaware of the approach of death. As he watched this beautiful, still world, Louis played with a thought that had come to him before. He had thought it as he had watched hunting seabirds, marveling at their ability to adjust their dives to compensate for the refraction of light in water. He had thought it as he had considered the pleasing geometry of the sharks, their gradation of color, their slide through the sea. He even recalled the thought coming to him in his youth, when he had lain on the roof of the cabin in the Kaweah Indian Reservation, looking up from Zane Grey to watch night settling over the earth. Such beauty, he thought, was too perfect to have come about by mere chance. That day in the center of the Pacific was, to him, a gift crafted deliberately, compassionately, for him and Phil. Joyful and grateful in the midst of slow dying, the two men bathed in that day until sunset brought it and their time in the doldrums to an end. Given how badly the men's bodies were faring, it would seem likely that their minds too would begin to fail. But more than 5 weeks into their ordeal, both Louis and Phil were enjoying remarkable precision of mind and were convinced that they were growing sharper every day. They continued quizzing each other, chasing each other's stories down to the smallest detail, teaching each other melodies and lyrics, and cooking imaginary meals. Louis found that the raft offered an unlikely intellectual refuge. He had never recognized how noisy the civilized world was. Here, drifting in almost total silence, with no sense other than the singed odor of the raft, no flavors on his tongue, nothing moving but the slow procession of shark fins, every vista empty save water and sky, his time unvaried and unbroken, his mind was freed of an encumbrance that civilization had imposed on it. In his head, he could roam anywhere, and he found that his mind was quick and clear, his imagination unfettered and supple. He could stay with a thought for hours, turning it about. He had always enjoyed excellent recall, but on the raft, his memory became infinitely more nimble, reaching back further, offering detail that had once escaped him. One day, trying to pinpoint his earliest memory, he saw a two-story building, and inside a stairway broken into two parts of 6 steps each, with a landing in between. He was there in the image, a tiny child toddling along the stairs. As he crawled down the first set of steps and moved toward the edge of the landing, a tall yellow dog stepped in front of him to stop him from tumbling off. It was his parents' dog, Askim, whom they had had in Olean when Louis was very little. Louis had never remembered him before. On the 40th day, Louis was lying beside Phil under the canopy when he abruptly sat up. He could hear singing. He kept listening. It sounded like a choir. He nudged Phil and asked him if he heard anything. Phil said no. Louis slid the canopy off and squinted into the daylight. The ocean was a featureless flatness. He looked up. Above him, floating in a bright cloud, he saw human figures silhouetted against the sky. He counted 21 of them. They were singing the sweetest song he had ever heard. Louis stared up, astonished, listening to the singing. What he was seeing and hearing was impossible. And yet, he felt absolutely lucid. This was, he felt certain, no hallucination, no vision. He sat under the singers, listening to their voices, memorizing the melody, until they faded away. Phil had heard and seen nothing. Whatever this had been, Louis concluded, it belonged to him alone. On the men drifted, several days with no food and no rain. The raft was a gelatinous mess, its patches barely holding on, some spots bubbling outward on the verge of popping. It wouldn't bear the men's weight much longer. In the sky, Phil noticed something different. There were more birds. Then they began to hear planes. Sometimes they'd see a tiny speck in the sky, sometimes two or more together, making a distant buzz. They were always much too far away to be signaled, and both men knew that as far west as they had probably drifted, these planes were surely Japanese. As the days passed, more and more specks appeared, every day arriving earlier. Louis had come to love sunrise and the warmth it brought, and each morning he'd lie with his eyes on the horizon awaiting it. On the morning of July 12th, the 46th day, the day that Phil had picked for their arrival at land, no sunrise came. There was only a gradual, gloomy illumination of a brooding sky. Phil and Louis looked up apprehensively. The wind caught them sharply. The sea began to arch its back onto the raft, sending the men up to dizzying heights. Louis looked out over the churning water and thought how lovely it was. Phil was fond of roller coastering over the big swells that came with storms, thrilled as he skidded down one and turned his face up to see the summit of the next. But this was ominous. To the west, something appeared, so far away that it could be glimpsed only from the tops of the swells. It was a low, gray-green wiggle on the horizon. Phil and Louis would later disagree on who saw it first, but the moment the sea tossed them up, the horizon rolled westward, and their eyes grasped it. They knew what it was. It was an island. Chapter 17. Typhoon. All day, under a dark, gyrating sky, Louis and Phil rode the swells, straining their eyes westward and feeling a weary thrill as the bump on the horizon peeked into view. Slowly, as the current carried them toward it, the island became more distinct. They could see a bright white line where waves dashed against something. Maybe a beach, maybe a reef. In the afternoon, one island became two, and then a dozen or so, lined up like rail cars. The castaways had expected that if they ever saw land, they'd be rapturous. Instead, they discussed it matter-of-factly. They were too weak for anything more, and there were pressing worries. Overhead, a huge storm was gathering. In training, Louis and Phil had memorized the geography of the Central Pacific. They knew that the islands ahead had to be part of the Gilberts or Marshalls, enemy territory. Between them, the two island groups had dozens of atolls and islands, so there was a good likelihood that there were places unoccupied by the Japanese. Louis and Phil decided to hang offshore until they found an island that looked uninhabited, or inhabited only by natives. They began rowing over the wind-chapped sea, turning parallel to the islands so they could wait until night to slip ashore. The sky broke all at once. A sudden slashing rain came down and the islands vanished. The ocean began heaving and thrashing. The wind slapped the raft in one direction, then another, sending it spinning up swells, perhaps 40 feet, then careening down into troughs as deep as canyons. Phil and Louis had drifted into what was almost certainly a typhoon. Wave after wave slammed into the raft, tipping it sideways and peeling it upward on the verge of overturning. To try to stop it from flipping, Louis and Phil bailed in water as ballast, positioning themselves on opposite sides to balance their weight, and lay on their backs to keep the center of gravity low. Knowing that if they were thrown loose, they'd never get back in, Louis reeled in the raft cord, looped it around the cushion sewn into the center of the raft, threaded it through a grommet, then wound it around his waist and Phil's waist, pulling it taut. They pushed their feet under the cushion, leaned back, and held on. Night fell, and the storm pounded. The raft raced up and down hundreds of mountains of water. At times in the darkness, they felt the strange lightness of flying as the raft was swept into the air off the tops of the waves. Louis felt more intensely afraid than he had felt as Green Hornet was falling. Across from him, Phil lay in grim silence. Both men thought of the nearness of the land they could no longer see. They feared that any second they'd be flung into a reef. Sometime in the night, the storm sagged and softened, then moved on. The swells remained, but their tops became smooth. Louis and Phil freed themselves from the raft cord and awaited daylight. In the dark, they could smell soil, greenness, rain washing over living things. It was the smell of land. It flirted with them all night, growing stronger. As dawn neared, they could hear the hiss of water scouring a reef. Exhausted, they decided to take turns napping, with one man on the lookout for land. Somewhere along the way, they both fell asleep. They woke in a new universe. They had drifted into the embrace of two small islands. On one island, they saw huts, trees heavy with fruit, but no people. They had heard of the Japanese enslaving native populations and moving them en masse off their home islands, and they thought that perhaps this had been the fate of this island's inhabitants. They pulled their shoes over their sore-pocked feet and began rowing for shore. From overhead came the whine of engines. They looked up and saw Zeros looping through combat maneuvers far too high for their pilots to notice the raft below. They rowed on. Louis had predicted that they'd find land on the 47th day. Phil had chosen the day before. Because they had spotted land on the day Phil had chosen and were about to reach it on the day Louis had chosen, they decided that they had both been right. They could see more islands now. Louis spotted a tiny island to their left and pointed it out to Phil, describing it as having one tree on it. Then a strange thing happened. The lone tree became two trees. After a moment's confusion, the men suddenly understood. It wasn't an island, and those weren't trees. It was a boat. It had been perpendicular to them, leaving only one mast visible. And then it had turned, bringing the rearward mast into view. Louis and Phil ducked. They rowed as fast as they could, trying to get to shore before the sailor spotted them. They were too late. The boat made a sharp turn and sped toward them. The weakened men couldn't row fast enough to escape. They gave up and stopped. The boat drew alongside the raft, and Louis and Phil looked up. Above them was a machine gun, mounted on the boat's bow. Along the deck stood a line of men, all Japanese. Each one held a weapon, pointed at the castaways. One of the Japanese opened his shirt and pointed to his chest. He seemed to want the Americans to do the same. As Louis opened his shirt, he braced himself, expecting to be shot. But no shot came. The man had only wanted to see if they were armed. One of the sailors threw a rope at the raft, and Louis caught it. Louis and Phil tried to climb onto the boat, but their legs were too weak. The sailors brought out a rope ladder, tied the castaways to it, and dragged them up, then pulled the raft aboard. On the deck, Louis and Phil attempted to rise, but their legs buckled. The Japanese were impatient for the men to move across the deck, so the Americans crawled on all fours. When they reached the mast, they were picked up and lashed to it. Their hands were bound behind their backs. One of the sailors began speaking to them in Japanese. He seemed to be asking questions. Louis and Phil offered responses, trying to guess what the man wanted to know. A soldier waved a bayonet past Louis's face, trying to hack off his beard. Another man cracked a pistol across Phil's jaw, then moved to do the same to Louis. Louis tipped his head forward in hopes that the sailor would aim for the front of his face. When the sailor swung, Louis jerked his head back. The man missed, but Louis smacked his head against the mast. The boat's captain approached and chastised the crewman. The mood changed, and Louis's and Phil's hands were untied. Someone gave the castaways cigarettes, but the ends kept lighting their beards on fire. Someone else brought them cups of water and one biscuit each. Louis took a bite of the biscuit and held it in his mouth, caressing it, feeling the flavor. He ate slowly, savoring each crumb. It was his first food in 8 days. A second boat pulled alongside the first. Louis and Phil were helped onto it, and it began moving. As it sailed, a crewman came to the castaways and fed them more biscuits and some coconut. Then a young sailor approached, Japanese-English dictionary in hand, and asked questions. Phil and Louis gave brief accounts of their journey. In time, the boat drew up to a large island. A sailor approached with two blindfolds and tied them around Louis's and Phil's heads. Men got on either side of them, grabbed their arms, and half-dragged, half-carried them off the boat. After a few minutes, Louis felt himself being laid down on something soft. His blindfold was taken off. He was inside an infirmary, lying on a soft mattress on an iron bed. Phil was on a bed beside his. There was a small window nearby, and through it he could see Japanese soldiers thrusting bayonets into dummies. An officer spoke to the Japanese surrounding the castaways, then spoke in English, apparently repeating his statement so Louis and Phil would understand him. "These are American flyers," he said. "Treat them gently." A doctor came in, smiled warmly, and examined Phil and Louis, speaking English. He smoothed ointment on their salt sores and burned lips, palpated their abdomens, took their temperatures and pulses, and pronounced them healthy. Louis and Phil were helped to their feet and led to a scale. They took turns standing on it, each with a man ready to catch him if his legs failed. Phil had weighed about 150 pounds when he had stepped aboard Green Hornet. Louis's war diary, begun shortly after he arrived in Hawaii, noted that he weighed 155 pounds. He believed that weight training had added another 5 pounds by the time of the crash. Now, Phil weighed about 80 pounds. According to different accounts, 5-foot-10-inch Louis weighed 67 pounds, 79.5 pounds, or 87 pounds. Whatever the exact number, each man had lost about half of his body weight, or more. On the doctor's orders, in came a bottle of Russian cognac and two glasses, which Louis and Phil quickly emptied. Then came a platter of eggs, ham, milk, fresh bread, fruit salad, and cigarettes. The castaways dug in. When they were done, they were helped into another room and seated before a group of Japanese officers who gaped at the shrunken canary yellow men. An officer, speaking English, asked how they had ended up there. Louis told the story as the Japanese listened in silent fascination, tracing the journey on a map. Louis and Phil knew where their journey had begun, but did not yet know where it had ended. The officers told them. They were on an atoll in the Marshall Islands. They had drifted 2,000 miles. As Japanese servicemen crowded around, the raft was spread out and the bullet holes counted. There were 48. The curious servicemen pressed toward the Americans, but the officers kept them back. An officer asked Louis where the bullet holes had come from. Louis replied that a Japanese plane had strafed them. The officer said that this was impossible, a violation of their military code of honor. Louis described the bomber in the attack. The officers looked at one another and said nothing. Two beds were made up, and Louis and Phil were invited to get as much rest as they wished. Slipping between cool, clean sheets, their stomachs full, their sores soothed, they were deeply grateful to have been received with such compassion. Phil had a relieved thought. They are our friends. Louis and Phil stayed in the infirmary for 2 days, attended by Japanese who cared for them with genuine concern for their comfort and health. On the third day, the deputy commanding officer came to them. He brought beef, chocolate, and coconuts, a gift from his commander, as well as news. A freighter was coming to transport them to another atoll. The name he gave sent a tremor through Louis. Kwajalein. It was the place known as Execution Island. After you leave here, Louis would long remember the officer saying, "We cannot guarantee your life." The freighter arrived on July 15th. Louis and Phil were taken into the hold and housed separately. The captain had bountiful portions of food sent to them. The prisoners ate all they could. One of the cruelties of starvation is that a body dying of hunger often rejects the first food it is given. The food on the atoll had apparently agreed with the castaways, but not the food on the freighter. Louis spent much of that day hunched over the ship railing, vomiting into the sea, while a guard held him. Phil's meal left him almost as quickly, but by a different route. That evening he had to be taken on at least 6 runs to the head. As the freighter drew up to Kwajalein on July 16th, the Japanese became harsh. On came the blindfolds, and Louis and Phil were taken onto what seemed to be a barge. When the barge stopped, they were picked up, heaved over men's shoulders, and carried. Louis felt himself bobbing through the air, then slapped down on a hard surface. Phil was dropped beside him. Louis said something to Phil, and immediately felt a boot kick into him as a voice shouted, "No!" An engine started, and they were moving. They were on the flatbed of a truck. In a few minutes, the truck stopped, and Louis was tugged out and flung over a shoulder again. There was walking, 2 steps up, a darkening, the sense that Phil was no longer near him, and the disorienting feeling of being thrown backward. Louis's back struck a wall, and he fell to a floor. Someone yanked off his blindfold. A door slammed, a lock turned. At first, Louis could barely see. His eyes darted about uncontrollably. His mind raced, flitting incoherently from thought to thought. After weeks of endless openness, he was disoriented by the compression of the space around him. Every nerve and muscle seemed in a panic. Slowly, his thoughts quieted and his eyes settled. He was in a wooden cell, about the length of a man and not much wider than his shoulders. Over his head was a thatched roof about 7 feet up. The only window was a hole about a foot square in the door. The floor was strewn with gravel, dirt, and wiggling maggots, and the room hummed with flies and mosquitoes, already beginning to swarm onto him. There was a hole in the floor with a latrine bucket below it. The air hung hot and still, oppressive with the stench of human waste. Louis looked up. In the dim light, he saw words carved into the wall. 9 Marines marooned on Macon Island, August 18th, 1942. Below that were names. Robert Allard, Dallas Cook, Richard Davis, Joseph Gifford.